welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body, a podcast from the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. I'm Dr. Saul Rosenthal, a health psychologist in the Boston area, and your host as we investigate the incredible connections between brain and body. Hello, and we are back with Penny Jean Gracefire. We have been talking about creativity, and in the last episode, she had been talking about the project she had done with the musician Dessa. And had really focused on what's sort of called a broken heart protocol, I suppose, or certainly a romance, looking at romance networks, as you talked about. And I want to kind of take it from there a little bit, maybe move it more towards what we traditionally think of as creative, but sort of as, I guess, as a bridge to that. You had also mentioned in the last episode you have your favorite network, which is the executive control networks, and some of your favorite tools. So I'd really would love to hear why that network is your favorite, and some of the tools that you, strategies that you use that you particularly like for creatives.
Sure. So I was going to say mildly joking, but even as I'm saying it, I'm thinking, am I really joking when I say the executive function network is my favorite out of the three? And I'm going to have to say maybe I'm not.
Well, you know what us clinicians think about jokes.
Right. I feel like sometimes what we end up focusing on is an excellent reflection of how we process. Like, as you know, I have done 20 plus years of education in our industry, trying to mentor, support, develop, and educate around how to use the tools that we have in clinically effective ways. And I have stated more times than I can remember that a clinician or a developer or designer will use platforms the way that they think the world and brains work. So it almost doesn't matter what's possible. The only ceiling that limits us is what we can imagine to do with the software features that we have available, hardware, software features that we have available, platform device features. And so the reason I state it this way is because one of the things I deeply appreciate about the array of options in our industry, having slow frequency options, ILF, ISF, slow cortical potential, having full frequency options, fast frequency options, the neuromodulatory umbrella where we've got feed forward and not just feed back. We can do various types of stim, electrical stim, right? Or photobiomodulation or pulsed electromagnetic field. And I want to pull pulsed and put it kind of front and center, because I think the genuine intersection between what we're doing with EEG and maybe what we're doing with stimulation is the pulsing. Because there's a lot of stimulation tools out there where you've got steady state wave, you know, steady state light, where it's just, you know, we've got one wavelength and we're just sort of pounding you with it, right? Or we've got, you know, we're picking a frequency potentially in an electromagnetic field and we're just giving you like straight up 10 hertz or, you know, like whatever it is alpha stim is doing with this sort of like a variable little electrocranial stimulation in its gradient range. We're going to introduce some type of stimulational information. And then we're just going to see how you respond at sort of a molecular metabolic level to that, right? The pulsing component, and this is why I think even with the photobiomodulation stuff, people get a little bit confused, because like historically and medically, we've used light therapy and red light to do wound healing and repair and a lot of peripheral, maybe even cosmetic, dermatological, you know, applications. Like there's such a strong history of using like a low-level laser and a red light to just do a variety of interventions. So when we start talking about transcranial pulsed red light or near infrared or, you know, photobiomodulation, the strong difference has been the pulsing capacity, like being able to turn the light off and on at specific frequencies that maybe reflect different recruitment asks of the brain. So instead of like, you know, putting some steady state, like, you know, trying to heal a peripheral wound, we're like turning lights off and on at frequencies over the brain. It's kind of a different thing. And so when we're thinking about executive function, I think one of the reasons that I'm a fan of working in that range is, again, harking back to the idea of like what creates what creates a creative drive? What is curiosity literally made out of? You cannot be curious and interested in not connecting and rearranging and world building if you don't have the bandwidth and you don't have the resources to do it. I think the biggest creativity killer is exhaustion. Like being under-resourced, it's just exhaustion and stress. And I'm even just framing stress as all the things happening that are essentially we have to expend resources on to just survive, right? And so when I'm thinking about how do I even just support creativity in general, I'm almost always kind of going for that executive function level. I think salience and default are important, orientation and prioritization, very important. When we think about true bandwidth capability, it's almost always going to be at that executive function level. We're trying to do multiple things simultaneously, right? So I think I end up hanging out in that range and saying it's a little bit my favorite because I think my true goal in almost all the neurotechnology application design frameworks from which I function is that idea of can I broaden the information highway for an individual so that they can manage more variables with less energy expenditure so that there is just something left to be curious and interested in the first place. We had joked a little bit during the break about the concept of creative drive, right? And that the idea is like, is it actually better to help creatives be less distressed? Like if they're more complacent and happy, does it make them less driven? Are they going to produce like, you know, less interesting art or maybe perform less tightly on the margin as an athlete? And it's a great question, right? Because ultimately, I think almost everything that drives most of us as people is that desire to connect, to see and be seen, to know and be known, and to feel a certain amount of meaning and significance, right? And so in many ways, almost all creativity is building, whether it's trying to find a medium in which to express yourself so that someone can experience it and experience you and then relate to you. and like almost everything is relationship building or relational in nature. And so people who feel distressed and disconnected will often have higher performance or productivity drives because they're really trying to complete that circuit. And so, you know, athletes who are performing for reasons, right? I got to make the big leagues. I got to make the big money. I've got to prove to my high school bully, you know, like I have to get the girl, like whatever the motivation is, right? Almost always there's going to be that small core of I wish to complete a circuit I haven't completed. I wish to be connected or seen. I need some sort of meaning or significance. And so I feel driven towards it. So if you do not feel disrupted or disconnected, do you still feel driven? And it's honestly a really great question, which Saul and I don't have the answer for, but we think is worth exploring overall and also just like at an individual level. I will make a personal statement. I feel like I have done fairly consistent, productive, creative work over the last 20 plus years, contributing to the development of various different ways to use software and software platforms and hardware. To stack them together, create sequences, create new cascades for feedback, like just thinking about all the different ways we have to use neurotechnology and to neuromodulate. I feel like I've been almost every year, when I think about it, sometimes I joke with my friends, I'm like, I look back on some of those earlier years where I was doing 6 or 7 or 8 conferences a year. And every year I was like, I need to have new material to talk about. I'm not talking about the same thing. You know, blessed those amongst us who have for some years. It, you know, I appreciate the resting on their laurels community, but it isn't me. And so I felt very kind of driven, right? Because it, part of my drivenness was there's so many things that could be helping people that we're not doing, and I want to see what's possible. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I was working multiple jobs, doing so many things, like kind of, you know, working 80, 90 hour weeks, constantly traveling, burning the candle at all three ends. And, you know, at, you know, having like a lot of personal disruption as well in my life and relationships at the time. So I look back on that and I think to myself, like, you know, I did some good work during that time, but I was also just exhausted and didn't have a lot of extra juice. These days, last handful of years in my life, I've been much more stable and settled, and I actually have way more resources to now devote towards that development and design interest that I had early in my career when I was still, you know, doing a lot of clinical work and a lot of educational work, and just didn't have the bandwidth to do the design and development that I really have been interested in. And so personally, I can say, as some of those stressors have been taken off my plate, that my capacity to now do even more interesting and develop things, I believe, has expanded.
Some more resources. Just not the same.
More resources, less expenditures of energy on basic survival. Now, it's not the same thing as being like, you know, a professional athlete. You, like, we all just watch the Olympics, you know, like, I feel like there's a certain amount of drive you kind of have to maintain. Mm-hmm. But I also, I'm thinking about how we discuss how athletes often age out. Naturally, that's because by the time you're 25, you're not 1/3 stem cells anymore, constantly regenerating and repairing. Like, you're just not at the physical peak you were, right? But at the same time, I think as we mature and we stabilize, the drivenness also stabilizes. And so it's not the fever pitch that it used to be. And I think thinking about creativity or productivity over a lifespan is critical for us even able being able to contextualize what that looks like, because you're going to be capable of things in your 20s, your teens and 20s, you're not capable of in your 40s and 50s, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. What is it they talk about, how, like, what is it, the 40s and 50s are maybe the best CEO years, right, of your life? Or if you really want to take someone who's like mature and wise and can make very big, broad ranging, informed, nuanced decisions, you really want somebody who's older. When we think about the life arc of what we're capable of doing, and even we're going to just be, you know, this is sort of stick to the original idea of even musical creativity, right? There are some musical groups that have had a sustained career over 40 or 50 years. They're still kind of doing interesting things later on. And then there are bands that have flamed out very quickly. Right. And so this idea of like, what are we, when we're thinking about potentially the underlying EEG or brain behaviors that represent our capacity to both connect and to create, I think it's also important to state that you're going to have different seasons of different apex creative capabilities throughout your life. And that if you are concerned about just continuing to replicate things that you were doing in earlier seasons at the same fever pitch level, that the limitations you're placing on yourself is the ceiling to your own creativity. We expect brains to age and change. We expect them to be capable of different things in different decades. And I think people need to start thinking, if you're going to be a career creative, you need to start thinking about what that means for you through every decade.
that raises so many questions, but the direction I'll go is about whether we can, or we have the tools to actually improve the creative process. So for example, I'm probably not pronounce his last name correctly, but John Grusellier, who used Alpha Theta training to improve dancers. And they were getting better scores on dance exams after the Alpha Theta training. So can we use some of these tools to improve that creativity?
Absolutely. 100%. One of the things about, say, for example, peak performance training that has allowed for us to sort of get away with what I would consider to be slightly simpler interventions has been the fact we're working with people at like peak sensitivity often. So we can make somewhat even marginal changes, right? Like we joke about, like, you know, you shave 2 points off somebody's golf game, that could be like a national tournament level change, right? People who are kind of operationally peak, who are working up there in those razor thin margins, almost any little nudge we do with any kind of baseline peak performance neurofeedback support honestly could kick them over just fine. So I have a lot of, you know, just general support for anyone who's working in peak performance and using what I would consider to be fairly straightforward, simple neurofeedback options, because yeah, they work. Why wouldn't you? I think that where potentially the need for slightly more customized or nuanced approaches would come from is when you've got performers or athletes or creatives who are doing either slightly more niche things or having more extensive mental and emotional or possibly even trauma-driven problems. When we talk about like writer's block or, you know, creativity blocks, or like, why can't I seem to perform like I used to, even though I said, oh, maybe it's just a different season. At the same time, nobody loves that answer.
Right.
And so your direct question of, can we do something? I think always yes. But that's where maybe the more advanced, nuanced options for creating more customer tailored approaches, I think that's where that would come in. Mm-hmm. And so like part of the reason I really enjoyed working with the Brainmaster platform over the years is because they have that very detailed SLRETA networking feature selection availability. I can literally go in and I can cobble together any combination of cortical brain regions and frequencies and build out those customized networks that allow for me to take, say, a 52-year-old man who, I have permission to talk about this. I was like double checking who signed which paperwork in the last like handful of years. I had a 52-year-old man who is a professional painter. And he's spent, you know, and we see a lot of painters whose work evolves over the years. Mm-hmm. He spent, you know, 30, 40 years essentially painting. And then he got a brain injury. And was like, my whole life I've been able to visualize what I was going to do. You know, like, I don't know. I can't imagine, like, do you understand the level on which I would have a love to have gotten a quantitative EEG on Michelangelo? Oh. Right? Where he was like, he could see the individual muscles that he was going to carve into a block of marble. Like, right. I can't. My brain doesn't do that. So this is a gentleman who, you know, made very beautiful, almost like realism level paintings. And he's like, you know, I could see everything before I did it. He had a brain injury and he couldn't anymore. And obviously this was like not even just career altering. This was like full identity breakdown for him. Right. Cause that was the way he processed the world. And so the conversation, you know, during that project arc between us was, what's possible to repair? Like, what could we recover? And if he couldn't recover what he was able to do before, what would it look like moving forward? And how could he reinvent and reimagine, right? The outcome of that was that we were able to repair and recover a good bit of visualization for him, because it was a pretty severe head injury, mm-hmm. right? Like you can imagine. And so we were able to recover a lot, but it didn't operate in the same way. So part of that journey was him being like, okay, I can now visualize things again, but it's not like it was. And so he had been a very sort of realism-oriented painter, and he ended up going a little bit more impressionist, softer, different types of layering. And originally it was very difficult for him to kind of, because he was like, this was my identity. Like this was the type of art I did. But what ended up occurring for him was that journey of trying to reinvent how he made art ended up being a deeply sort of therapeutic, all the way back to childhood and forward, you know, deeply therapeutic experience for him where as he learned how to make different art, he had to re-understand what it meant for him to be him and how he expressed himself to the world. And by the time that we were kind of done working together, he ended up in, you know, I'm not the same person that I was, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And I am actually a softer, less harsh person than I was. And in a way, me expressing myself in this way actually is a better reflection of where I am. Like, yeah, I got to give a lot of kudos to his therapist, you know, they were really doing the heavy lifting and a lot of that kind of reframing with him. But I, like he had done like 2 years of work with meds and talk therapy and had not been able to make any progress. And 30 sessions of a customized Esloretta network. And us kind of talking about how to reconnect and rebuild some level of visualization and then what that could look like going forward, what he could do with it. You know, I think it was maybe 3-4 months that we worked together. That changed his whole foundation and he was able to move forward in a different way. And so again, create. There's another phrase that I think about frequently, which is impermanence is not irrelevance. And that, you know, I think sometimes we think of creativity, like creating something. We have to create a thing and it's got to be perfect in the final version and it has to last forever, you know, as like a monument to what we did. Reasonable, especially considering if you are building a skyscraper, we kind of do need it to hang in there for a little while at least. But this idea of that a creative brain, a healthy, flexible, adaptive brain, that every 7 to 10 years we're a different person, and that creativity and that emotional stability and connection and relational, you know, navigation is always about continuing to update and adapt through all those seasons of change. Nobody escapes the aging arc except by literally dying too early.
Right.
And so if you're still here to have to, you know, to put the effort into the adaptation and learning, that's what I think that the EEG and the neuromodulation helps with, is the state flexibility, that the executive functions being able to assess what is immediately relevant, maybe what isn't any longer, to reprioritize, to continuously update and adapt as we go. Like, I think that's the one thing we're able to do for people that is really difficult to find, because you can have a decade of talk therapy and tell yourself things you need to be able to do, but if your brain will simply not do it, how are you supposed to talk yourself into like a brain shift?
Right. Right. But the neurofeedback can help lead that brain to the shift. And I can see where you would benefit from the more complex approaches than, you know, I happily say I do it simple, but yeah, I can absolutely see where these more complex approaches would really help in making that brain more flexible, making it be able to sort of not perseverate shift when it needs to shift.
Simple is valid. The only reason we're simple you know, sometimes runs into its own limitation, is that the simple interventions inherently rely on the rest of the system's structural integrity and capability to take it and integrate it in and make it useful. When there's been enough structural damage that the system cannot take it and do something useful with it, then being able to expand out the blueprint or the model that we're giving the system and saying, hey, you don't have to make all the decisions. We'll help you figure out which frequencies need to pair up and which brain areas need to be communicating better and syncing up. When we're doing a little bit, holding more of that structure for them as they're trying to sort of recalibrate and remap, and that's what I mean when I say things like more sophisticated or fancy options. I just mean holding more of the structural ask so that the brain has to make less internal decisions about how to apply what we've given it, right? And I think that when we're dealing with people who are just unable to do it themselves, then that ends up being more accessible for them in that rebuild phase.
I want to sort of shift a little bit to, we've been talking a lot about how we can enhance or support creativity. I kind of want to go the other direction, which is using biometrics to create. And this is going to go back to simple, I suspect, because I don't think we really have a sophisticated way of doing it, but we have some interesting things going on. So you work with Jason Snell, who's a musician who uses biometrics to create music. Could you talk a little bit about sort of how that collaboration came about and kind of your take on it?
I really appreciate Jason Snell's work because he's doing a couple of things that I think are really important. One is that he is going all the way back to the roots of Joe Kamiya's work, mm-hmm. and this idea of having an external indicator of an internal state. One of Jason's driving interests is understanding the transcendental state. Mm-hmm. And he was originally a DJ, right? He's had some very fun kind of experiences with the transcendental state that people can experience maybe in a group rave situation or just like, you know, whatever. And so he has some interest in exploring that. And I think that was kind of what drove him initially, if I remember correctly from his, you know, sharing some of his origins with me, what drove him initially into looking like, is it possible to induce or support the sort of moving into more of a transcendental state for people by looking at what their brain's doing and then maybe using external feedback to help create it, right? Mm-hmm. So part of what he's been doing is hooking up people in small groups, looking for a certain amount of maybe cooperation or synchrony in the group behavior to then drive some sounds or potentially even drive some visual or light changes in some external, it's a great question. I think he's actually using Bluetooth, if I'm not mistaken, but I think he's got some external light pods and a few other like small, you know, sensory producing platform. So there's some audio and some visual to some of the work that he's done. I know that he's done a few projects where he has set up some lights and made them, you know, motion sensitive and responsive. He's done a variety of things with lights and with sounds. And then he has begun to tie that together to, okay, we're looking for your brain to make a change. How's that going to show up in the sounds or potentially in the lights? So this idea of being able to create, you know, Bill Scott and his brain paint with the fractals and the visuals. I think a lot of people have been very drawn to that over the years because it's this idea of like, I am creating a thing with my brain, you know, hands-free fractal creation. Like, I think everyone is a little interested in the idea of being able to drive, control, influence. There's a very natural interest in that because us being able to influence our environment is one of the key survival needs, right? Mm-hmm. The key elements of agency. I do a thing and the environment responds to me. You know, there's a certain amount of like agency and leverage that feels very almost like safe and satisfying. Like I'm being listened to and acknowledged, right? And so I think everyone who does any type of sort of feedback loop with their environment, whether it's a conversation with someone who's a good attentive listener, or some streetlights that are, you know, changing colors because you made more alpha. Whatever it is, I think there's a core satisfaction and interest people have in that type of feedback loop. That's the only reason neurofeedback works, is our interest in that feedback loop.
Right.
And so Jason's work, and I think especially in the last year or two, because he's been at this for a while, he's done a really excellent job of actually programming his own interface to take the EEG inputs and then redistribute them to drive some colors and some sounds and maybe some visual displays. I really appreciate a lot of what he's doing, because he's trying to map out, I think, he is trying to map out what it looks like when people are in different states. Mm-hmm. And he's literally trying to do it with a visual and an auditory medium, right? This is not dissimilar to what we've been doing over the years with neurofeedback, but it's a little bit more true to the origins of Joe Kamiya's work, where he's asking for a certain amount of internal awareness of state to correlate to maybe the changes in the lights and sounds. Mm-hmm. I think that is super interesting. And I think in some ways, a very core component of creativity is that, I think you started off at the beginning with that awareness, that self-awareness, the self-reference. And so the reason I frame it that way is working with Jason has also helped me to, the majority of the work I've done over the years has been, can I create feedback loops that recruit the engagement of the orientation levels of the brain and the prioritization mechanisms of the brain, regardless of the awareness, intentional attention and engagement of the individual. Mm-hmm. So I've gone very much in a different direction than a lot of traditional neurofeedback, because the limitation of you need to know what you're doing for it to work was not working with autistic kids,
right,
people with severe traumatic brain injury, people who had like some functional challenges. I couldn't get them to purposefully pay attention and like, you know, and so this was very much the core concern about, you know, the behavioral learning roots of some of our approaches, which was, if you don't know what's going on, you can't learn. And I was like, cool. Okay. So if you have to understand what's happening to learn, how do babies work?
Right.
There's gotta be some underlying mechanisms that we can connect with. And so I'd very much gone in, and I would say with a certain amount of consistent success, creating neurotech applications that really leaned into, it's my job to recruit your central nervous system's attention and give it information it makes sense of and helps you reconnect and function and form networks. Like, I'll take that on. That's on me, you know? But it is a very different approach to say, okay, you are an intentional participant. You are going to pay attention to your state. You were going to attempt on purpose maybe to shift into some different states. And then you're going to get some environmental indicators that you're doing so. And we're kind of co-creating these intentional attempts at state shifting together. The creation of a state, an intentional state, I think is just a really interesting pursuit and something that you can't do with everybody. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate Jason's work, not just because he's doing super interesting stuff with like external feedback components, right, environmentally, right, but also because it's the co-creation process. We as therapists, all the way back to the beginning, we're always co-creating a session experience, right, with whoever we're working with. And I think that we have a lot of responsibility as sort of creative house designers, right, for to customize that experience and make it applicable. But the idea of having someone who's able to really get into that journey with you, and then you get to do fun things like make stuff light up, being able to see something, a third party outside of you, right? You've got Jason, you've got a participant, and now you've got a little light box. Mm-hmm. Right? It creates like a whole third element of environmental connection that is, you know, you've got two people looking at each other and one saying, are you getting there? And the other one saying, I'm getting there. But now you've got like a little light going off saying, oh, no, definitely, we're there. It's a whole other level.
Well, it seems, going back again to the beginning of our discussion, that it's almost prototypical world building.
Yes.
That co-creation and trying to move towards what create, you know, something that is creative, whatever that means. Well, as we sort of move to wrap up, is there any one thing you think our audience should know about creativity from the work you've done?
I would love to give you what I think the neuroscience version of yes and is. Mm-hmm. So I am not a person who has purposefully ever done improv, like situationally in a group. I'm a fan of most comedy. But I think if you're familiar with comedy at all, you've probably heard of the yes and, mm-hmm. right? Being able to sort of roll with a situation and adapt and improvise based on what's given you. I think as people who are doing neuroscience research and investigation and discussion and sharing of like the frameworks and paradigms that we're encountering and building together, I think that what has occurred is there has been a bit of a conflation between mismatch and error detection mm-hmm. when it comes to interacting with each other. I think the limits to our shared creativity as an industry trying to understand brains and each other is that when we encounter something that we haven't heard before or seen before, or someone is saying something different than what we've already learned or assumed, there's an error detection reflex that kicks in. And I would encourage people to try to stay in mismatch before you move into error detection. Mm-hmm. Because if you encounter something new or contrary to what you've already known or experienced yourself, remember that your construct is not the dictator of reality, that other people are experiencing extremely different constructs than you. And that instead of it having to be sort of a, what is it the kids call it, a battle for dominance, instead of one of you having to be the correct framework, the idea that multiple frameworks exist and your capacity to expand and include multiple frameworks literally just makes you more capable of connecting to other people who then you can express to and even your own drive, because that's what a lot of neuroscience people are doing. Like, we learn some stuff and then we want to tell people mm-hmm. about what we've seen or what's going on, right? And so your ability to express what you're experiencing to them, to some degree, is going to be contingent on your ability to understand how they receive information and what their world looks like. So if you can register a mismatch and go, oh, that's interesting, instead of, oh, that's distressing and in need of correction, then your own creative capacity will expand.
Well, Penny Jean, thank you so much for joining us here on Healthy Brain, Happy Body. There's a lot to think about, and look forward to more of the work you're doing in not just the creative realm, but in all the realms.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us on Healthy Brain, Happy Body. Subscribe to this podcast by clicking the subscribe here link in the show notes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy Healthy Brain, Happy Body, please rate us and leave reviews at Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get the podcast. Reviews help us reach more listeners, and that's more people who can learn about and benefit from biofeedback, neurofeedback, and other mind-body approaches to health. Also, let us know what you think by sending us email. Our address is healthybrain@nrbs.org. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is produced and edited by me. The theme music is Catch It by Coma Media. It is a production of the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. Go to nrbs.org to find out more about the organization, including our trainings, monthly webinars, and yearly conference. All opinions expressed are those of our guests and not the NRBS.
This podcast is not meant to replace advice from qualified healthcare providers. Healthy Brain Happy Body is supported by the sponsors of NRBS. Be sure to join us on our next episode as we continue to explore the keys to our well-being on Healthy Brain, Happy Body.